the fact that we have IMAX theaters and 3D and we carry supercomputers around in our pockets in the form of these cell phones that have incredible graphics capabilities. These are good tools. I'm not telling you to throw your phones away by any stretch. Don't hear me saying that, but you got to know that these are affecting our ability to read the Bible well.
Welcome to Mid-America Reformed Seminary's Roundtable Podcast, a broadcast where the faculty of Mid-America discuss everything from Reformed theology, cultural issues, and all things seminary. This is episode 70, and I'm your host, Jared Luchibor, Director of Marketing. Thank you for joining us. Have you struggled reading prophetic literature in the Bible? Books like Ezekiel and Daniel that have such bizarre imagery, giving you a headache when you attempt to decipher its meaning? Well, sitting down with me over the next few weeks is Associate Professor of Old Testament Studies, Reverend Andrew Compton, who I believe is quite capable of speaking to this subject matter, especially since he's currently writing a dissertation treating Ezekiel. What does it mean to look at prophetic literature in high def? Well, in today's episode, he'll give us some pointers on reading prophecy properly, that we might have a better understanding as we read. Here's Reverend Compton.
But lately, I've been, well, of course, I'm dissertating on the book of Ezekiel, as a lot of people around here at the seminary know. And Ezekiel has its own kind of fantastic imagery and issues like that. But I've also been dipping into Daniel a bit more intensely, preaching out of a few of the chapters, specifically the visionary chapters, starting in chapter 7 through to the end. And so a lot of these kind of Daniel things are floating through my head. Daniel had his own images going through his head, and so I've got my own Daniel images going through my head.
Yep.
So I thought maybe this is a great time to just reflect on some topics relative to, to Daniel in particular, because he does say things that have such relevance even to the epoch in which we live now, but also just as they relate to biblical interpretation in general, because books like Daniel and books like Ezekiel and books like Revelation, I know I'm dipping into Dr. Menninger's territory here, but right, these intimidate people. Even the Olivet Discourse is something at the end of Matthew that's just incredibly intimidating for people dealing with this kind of prophecy. And so it's worth spending a little bit of time reflecting on it. It might be good to just even kind of back the truck up a bit and survey what we're dealing with. Because most people dive right into Daniel, let's say, or Ezekiel 38 and 39 with Gog and Magog. And right away, they start trying to connect the dots. Who's Gog?
You're talking about Russia, right?
Right. Well, yeah, that's okay. What people claim, right? You go Gog and Magog. Oh, and there's Rosh, the head. And Rosh sounds like Rush. Oh, Russia. There we go. That's not a great way to do exegesis, but sure. It doesn't stop the whole lot of people. But part of it is thinking hermeneutically about a lot of this. So we can't do everything. I think there's a few points we can get at. But let's do this. We'll read a few verses just from Ezekiel 1. And first we'll look at how baffling it is, but then also try to think of how we might unpack some of that. So Ezekiel 1, verse 4, he says, "As I looked, behold, a storm wind was coming from the north, a great cloud with fire flashing forth continually and a bright light around it, and in its midst something like a glowing metal in the midst of the fire. Within it there were figures resembling four living beings, and this was their appearance. They had human form. Each of them had four faces and four wings. Their legs were straight, and their feet were like a calf's hoof, and they gleamed like burnished bronze. Under their wings on their four sides were human hands. As for the faces and wings of the four of them, their wings touched one another. Their faces did not turn when they moved. Each went straight forward. As for the form of their faces, each had the face of a man. All four had the face of a lion on the right and the face of a bull on the left, and all four had the face of an eagle. Such were their faces. Their wings were spread out above. Each had it two touching one another, two touching another being, and two covering their bodies. And each went straight forward. Wherever the spirit was about to go, they would go without turning as they went. In the midst of the living beings, there was something that looked like burning coals of fire, like torches darting back and forth among the living beings. The fire was bright, and the lightning was flashing from the fire, and the living beings ran to and fro like bolts of lightning." And then one last little blurb here. Already, I'm sure our listeners are being a bit bewildered. Verse 15, "Now as I looked at the living beings, behold, there was one wheel on the earth beside the living beings for each of the four of them. The appearance of the wheels and their workmanship was like sparkling beryl, and all four of them had the same form, their appearance and workmanship being as if one wheel were within the other. Wherever they moved in any of their four directions without turning as they moved. As for their rims, they were lofty and awesome, and the rims of all four of them were full of eyes round about. Wherever the living beings moved, the wheels moved with them. And whenever the living beings rose from the earth, the wheels rose also. Wherever the spirit was about to go, they would go in that direction. And the wheels rose close beside them, for the spirit of the living beings was in the wheels. Whenever those went, these went. And whenever those stood still, these stood still. And whenever those rose from the earth, the wheels rose close beside them, for the spirit of the living beings was in the wheels."
Whew. Yikes. Well, you're not saying that Ezekiel saw E.T. here, right? Yeah,
that's a fun thing. Is how many? It's interesting how many UFO cults do appeal to Ezekiel 1.
Seriously,
and in fact, even is it Farrakhan, who the Nation of Islam? Nation of Islam, I think, in some of its writers, its vision of mothership comes from Ezekiel 1. And there's just a whole bunch of this
wow.
UFO language that people read into that because it is pretty bizarre,
right?
You know, it's sometimes people are afraid to admit that about God's word, that this is puzzling and completely baffling. At least with Daniel, after he sees these visions, he just says he was completely overwhelmed. Sometimes he was so befuddled, he was sick physically. It's like, so look, this is not easy stuff. We don't have to be all pious and pretend like this is just an easy passage to unpack. But there's a few reasons why something like this strikes us as more bewildering than wonderful. Of course, as we just said, it's bewildering even to a prophet like Daniel. So, and actually, Ezekiel falls on his face when he sees all this as well. So this is pretty heavy for them anyway. But we have things in our day that make reading this kind of thing just feel like such a burden. And that's part of what we need to get better at if we're going to appreciate visionary prophecy in general, apocalyptic literature, books like Ezekiel, books like Daniel, books like Revelation, is just being better readers. I think one place we see this is just the fact that this kind of literature is sort of like the high def of the Bible. I've written this in some places, and I've tried to bring this up in preaching. You know, you got to think of this kind of stuff as the Bible's version of high def. I still remember the first time I saw a high-def TV screen. It was at family at Thanksgiving, and there was a football game on, and the sheen off the helmets blew my mind. Just I was looking close, thinking that's more realistic than real life. Just how clear the lights, the arena lights mm-hmm. gleaming off the helmets on that high-def TV. I think if we commit to viewing things like this as the Bible's version of high def, we're going to be in a better place, right? That clarity, the point of this is to really impress us with the sharpness. Now, that sounds ironic because this doesn't seem very sharp. It seems very fuzzy, if anything.
Pixelated prophecy.
Okay. Yeah. Sounds like a tech guy just said that. Well, no, but if we can then say, well, what filmmakers do, who's the guy who did Avatar?
James Cameron.
Yeah, thank you. Right, what he was doing with Avatar and with CGI and what a lot of filmmakers have done with 3D graphics mm-hmm. and, you know, imagine the biblical writers are trying to do the same thing.
Sure.
But they're doing it with words. I mean, they don't have TVs. They don't have CGI that they can work with, but they have the human imagination.
Mm-hmm.
And the sad thing is we live in an era where the human imagination has fallen on rough times. We live in a bit of an age of imagination atrophy. So I almost think we need to start off this series by making a plea for people getting into a workout plan, right? It's not not necessarily going down to Anytime Fitness or Planet Fitness. I mean, that's fine too. Go do that. But we need to have an imagination workout. We gotta start getting on track. And some of that starts with the fact that we live in this real techie age. I mean, we have so many tech distractions that make it hard to appreciate Daniel and to read Daniel or Ezekiel or Revelation. again, people have been baffled by these long before there was tech, but tech has made it that much harder. Right, what do we need to imagine things for when James Cameron has done all the work for us? I still remember, I think the first time my kids and I put on the, you know, these new Chronicles of Narnia, newish. I think they've been 15 years now, but but the newer Chronicles of Narnia came out, and we put in, I think, The Voyage of the Dawn Treader, and my I'll never forget my daughter. A few minutes into it, she said, "Oh, that's Caspian," or "Oh, that's," I don't remember what the reference is, but she says, "Oh, I guess I imagined it wrong." And it was,
wow,
it was funny. And my wife, you know, my wife chimes in and goes, "No, you didn't imagine it wrong. This is the filmmaker's imagination,
right?
And your imagination of how you thought about The Voyage of the Dawn Treader by C.S. Lewis, that's fine." But it kind of stood out that, you know, look at that. That instinct we have to sort of default to what we see.
Mm-hmm.
And hers was, "Oh, I imagined it wrong. I should have been viewing that." But that's part of the genius of this kind of literature, is that it gives us these, it places all these impressions upon us and forces our own brains to start processing them and start filling in the details and making connections between things. And the fact that we have IMAX theaters and 3D, and we carry supercomputers around in our pockets in the form of these cell phones that have incredible graphics capabilities, these are good tools. I'm not telling you to throw your phones away by any stretch. Don't hear me saying that. But you got to know that these are affecting our ability to read the Bible well. They're affecting our ability to read anything well, but especially to read the Bible well, because we have these things doing all the work for us. I mean, as a kid, right? If there was something I didn't know anything about, then I was sort of raised to go consult the World Book Encyclopedia. You know, where I'd ask my parents a question, my dad'd say, "Let's go get the World Book." We'd pull it down and and look at whatever the entry was. And more often than not, it was just text. You know, again, it was just a description of whatever, you know, Madagascar or whatever my question had been. It wasn't a picture, maybe a map. But now if you Google Madagascar, I don't know why I picked that, but you know, now you get YouTube videos of somebody taking a tour and introducing you to all the lemurs or whatever your thing is. So we just don't need to be really pondering and reflecting over images and descriptions and trying to piece them together. And so tech is causing us problems.
Sure.
I mean, even think of once upon a time, right? You know, you'd send a letter to grandma and grandpa. "Good news. Little Billy just ate his first corn on the cob. It was so cute. He had butter dripping down, you know, his elbows. And then he ran to the window and put two big handprints on it." You know, you'd write that, and grandma and grandpa would be off in whatever town, and they'd get the letter a week and a half later, and they would read it, and they'd laugh, and they'd remember all the times, and they would, in their mind, picture what they know of the kid. There's this incredible mental process going on of recreating that event that would be so memorable. But nowadays, does anybody do that? Well, no, you'd take a video of the kid eating his corn. You'd take five pictures of the handprints on the window, and you'd make a photo collage, and you'd put it on Instagram, and you'd tag grandma and grandpa. And right. So, again, something gets lost then at every level, especially for grandma and grandpa. Something gets lost from us, because I don't have to now interpret and articulate what Junior just did with his corn on the cob.
Yeah.
I can just let the camera do it, and I can just let grandma and grandpa process and figure it out. All this to say, tech is... it's causing us some trouble. We just have to be mindful of that. And I think it's really valuable. The more we can put the phones away, put them on pause, and read paper, you know, try to do things that force our own brains to think through things. And that actually brings to kind of a second point. I mentioned why these kinds of texts are hard, because of our imaginations are weak, because tech does all the work for us. But also, tech is keeping us from reading sometimes, and that is also really hurting us. Now, I know a lot of people say, well, I read off my screen. And I can really appreciate that. You know, that is a really cool thing about the abilities of all computers, but especially of your phones and the things. You can carry your phone with you, and you can tap into Google Books and read text that the nearest library copy is in, you know, Europe. But you can read it on your phone. And that's nice that you can skim through your Bible with your phone, but we read differently. And neurologists have even noticed that that we don't read as deeply. We don't read as well when we read off screens. And so this is kind of a plea to read books, to read paper, to get a newspaper. People say, well, I don't want to waste the paper. Again, I appreciate that. Once upon a time, that was the only media available for conveying the news. But and now e-media does a better, an easier job, but and maybe a more environmental job, we could argue. There's certainly value to trying to be as environmentally responsible as possible. But we lose something when we're not reading it on paper. And if we can do that, I think we should. You're not going to read the Bible the same on a screen than in a book form.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, the more reading we can do on paper, newspapers, magazines, fiction, especially for Daniel and Ezekiel and Revelation and these kinds of texts, reading sci-fi, maybe that's not your thing, but just fantasy, things that allow the imagination to churn is really important, because that's the point of this sort of literature. What we just read in Ezekiel is using a bunch of impressions and images to convey something. Right, you saw the number 4 all over the place. And if you're a good reader, you know how 4 is used in literature and used all over to convey this kind of whole totality, completeness. 4 points of the compass is usually where we go with that. There's these 4 creatures, and they have 4 faces, and their faces have all these different associations, right? There's the there's the face of a man, the face of a bull, the face of a lion, the face of an eagle, each creature has certain attributes and properties that are very vivid. And yet each of these angelic beings or whatever they are then combines everything you associate with these. And then each one of these creatures is now parked at one corner of the throne of God, where Ezekiel is going to see the glory of the Lord on wheels. And that's an even stranger dynamic. Elsewhere, we're going to hear of that, the throne of God. You see that imagery used, and it's wheels and this kind of mobility there too. What is up with these wheels? A lot of people just get headaches thinking about the eyeballs on them, and I'm glad my tires don't have eyeballs on them. but here too, I remember a couple years ago a video. Is it the Space Shuttle Endeavor that's in Los Angeles? I saw it once they installed it in Los Angeles at the Natural Science History Museum, Natural History Museum. But there's pictures of them wheeling the space shuttle from LAX through the streets of LA out to right next to the Coliseum where the museum is. It's staggering to see this behemoth going past people's apartments on wheels. And you know, I think too, when you think of the glory of the Lord in Ezekiel 1 and its ability to move around, there's almost something more impressive about the glory being accompanied by wheels, where it just emphasizes the great heaviness. You know, obviously, the word glory is related to the word heavy. The Hebrew word kavod is etymologically related to kaved, you know, to be heavy.
Mm-hmm.
That heaviness, that weight is almost further underscored by wheels, yet also its mobility. All of a sudden, as we've begun to draw on other things from other readings we've done, general imagination, general sort of hunches we get from things that are impressive, all of a sudden what we just read in Ezekiel 1 starts to make a particular kind of impact on us.
Right.
And we begin to really benefit from it. And I think that we really want to pursue being able readers who can best appreciate this. And maybe one final thing I'll say, of course, seminary education is a wonderful thing. And I think as many of our listeners as have the ability to even take a class or something or whatever, you should do that. There's great value. But one need not do that to become a better reader. My dad was telling me a while back of a fire captain he worked with who always wrote really good reports. And here was a guy who didn't have any, you know, what you'd call humanities training. I don't know that he went to a college. If he did, I don't know that he really did any, you know, kinds of literature classes or anything like that. But he's really good at writing reports. And the thing that stood out to my dad is you would always find this captain reading novels. Usually it was like Louis L'Amour, these Western novels and things. But just from reading, he was equipped to use language well. And I think the more we can do that in our own reading habits, the more equipped we are to look at these kinds of things too.
With those preparatory remarks by Reverend Compton, next time he'll look at these principles for reading prophetic literature applied to the book of Daniel, chapter 7 to be precise, and the imagery of apocalyptic beasts. For more podcast episodes, you can find us on our website at midamerica.edu/podcasts, on YouTube, and wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts. Be sure to search for and subscribe to Mid-America Reformed Seminary's Roundtable. I'm Jared Luchabor. Till next time.